When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Wait, wait, wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety. Today we have two remarkable women whose intertwined journeys illuminate the path from intergenerational trauma to healing. They are sisters Patty and Karen Clark.
Patty has been on our podcast before and is an award-winning author. Her acclaimed books, This Way Up and Recovery Road Trip, blend personal narrative with practical tools for emotional sobriety and self-discovery.
And Karen is a counselor and educator with over 35 years of experience. She specializes in addiction, trauma, and intergenerational healing. She is passionate about the power of the human heart and psyche to heal.
Raised in a home marked by addiction and dysfunction, both sisters face their own struggles with substance use. Together, they've not only broken familial cycles, but have also dedicated their lives to helping others find healing and purpose.
So today we're going to talk about their experiences, family dynamics, addiction, and the transformative power of sisterhood. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for being here. We're getting right into it. Patty, you spoke to us about your mother being identified as an alcoholic. So how did family dynamics play out between your parents and the two of you as sisters?
Oh, that's a big question. Briefly, as I said, our mother was the identified alcoholic, so she was the scapegoat for sure, but our father was also a practicing alcoholic, but he looked good. I'll briefly say Karen's my older sister, and so a lot of it was transferred onto her. And I haven't talked about this. God, I'm going to start crying already. I haven't talked about this a lot in past interviews, but with Karen here, I just really want to say, just how instrumental she was in stepping up. My mother died when I was 16. Karen was 20. And she basically invited me along to things and took care of me in a way without becoming a mother, but was a real present big sister in a way that was amazing. And so I just wanted to say that to everybody, Karen, because I love you.
That's so lovely. So we know there's a lot of dysfunction in my family. But because my parents were so dysfunctional, it really affected my relationship with my brother. Without really realizing it, we were pit against each other, and I don't even think they meant to do it. So was there anything in the family dynamics between you two?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that you've done this on other podcasts or in your own work, but there's the identified roles in a family system. That really originated back in the 80s, well, even before that with Virginia Satir. And then John Bradshaw made it incredibly famous, as did Claudia Black and some of the real revolutionaries in this field. So I was the first child. I was the hero. I was expected to get perfect grades. I was expected to be perfect. I was expected to be strong and resilient when I was super sensitive. And it wasn't like I had to babysit Patty.
But it was expected that I be the older sister and that I give in and I relinquish. And I already felt as though I didn't have enough. So I would get angry. And that's the way that the pitting against each other really started. And because I was the hero and I was serious and I was pushed in school and I was pushed to skip a grade and all of those pieces, Patty was able to take on a more playful role. And I was jealous as hell because she was cute. And I was just serious and silent. So the dynamic was there from the very beginning. And it's just so clear in most family systems. It's like what Virginia Satir said is all systems do this. It's just that the more dysfunctional the system is, the more prevalent it becomes, mm-hmm. the more pronounced it becomes, and the more boundaried in our roles we become. If it's healthy, we can move around in the roles, but that wasn't the case. So, and on top of that, I became my mother's caretaker, and I wanted to save her, whereas Patty just wanted to get the hell out. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking for you. You go ahead.
In those roles, because Karen did take that, what I became as the younger sister, shorter, I was, you know, skinny and more of a tomboy. I became the mascot. I was fun. And the way that I would diffuse our pressure cooker is by making jokes, jumping around, being that one. And I got the laughs. And if all else failed, I would do things like knock things over unconsciously. But I was constantly spilling things and knocking things over almost in a very unconscious way of diffusing. And I became like a sidekick almost to my father.
Mm-hmm.
Because Karen moved over to my mother and became the caretaker. And I, of course, it wasn't so obvious to say it's what I was, what I chose. But I became my father's sidekick, like it or not. And so he would favor me in ways that served me. Now, I didn't know that at the time, obviously, you know. Karen and I, just to let you guys know, we've done a lot of work. We've talked a lot about this, and we won't go into the full process. But after we had both done our own therapy and done our own work in recovery, we could see some of these just toxic roles. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, it served me better because I had an easier path. I really did. Mm-hmm. And Karen was right when she said, I just wanted to get the fuck out. I just did not want to be there anymore. And so I just looked for any ways out. And my father thought it was cool that I wanted to travel so much.
Right.
So that became a favorable thing. So, but also Karen and I both remember a time when we had some guests for dinner and in front of these, which we didn't have often, in front of these guests, Dad said, my daughters eat like birds. Patty's a sparrow and Karen's a vulture. We're sitting at the dinner table. Both of us just freeze. It's like there's no winning in a situation like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my first addiction was food.
Was food.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I was a compulsive overeater, which is so common for females in these family systems. I wasn't old enough to even think to use substances, quote unquote, yet. But I sure used, you know, I used to call my four food groups white flour, white sugar, fat, and coffee. Those are my four food groups. Give me cake, give me bread and butter, give me ice cream. I wonder if that maybe came out of being told I was a vulture. And why was I a vulture? Because it was important that I be a good girl. And good girls clean their plates.
Right, right.
And, you know, we've talked about roles, and now I think it is important. It feels important to me because this isn't just about us. It's about the way this shows up for so many people who mm-hmm. come out of these family systems. And mm-hmm. So the hero is usually the first child, but not always. And then it's usually what's next is the scapegoat or the rebel, because the second child looks and says, this bozo is getting all the positive attention, is doing everything right. I haven't got a chance. I always say the hero is the one who's getting straight A's and is on a path and a track to become the doctor or the professor or the whatever it might be that's super cool with great grades. So the second person says, I'm shooting up and driving my Harley through the front window. And that's kind of how that shows up. And then the third child says, there is no space for me. None. So they become invisible. They become the lost child. They lock themselves in their room. Used to be get involved in a lot of art and creativity. And then the fourth one says, this is insane. I'm going to be the mascot, lampshade on my head. Another word that's often used is clown. And the reality is we move around.
Interchange. Yeah.
But we tend to be very fixed in one in a pronounced way because most families aren't four kids perfectly. And the interesting piece in our case that I think is a good example is when my mom died, because I was fighting her alcoholism for my whole childhood. I would beg her. I would hide it. I would cry. I would get angry. When I became a teenager, I became violent, enraged about her drinking because I loved her. I wanted her in my life. Sorry. And when she died, after all of my energy around drinking, I started drinking alcoholically the day of her funeral.
Wow.
I bought alcohol and hid it in my car. I was in charge of the funeral, of course, because my dad had left and moved back into the house. And I said, there will be no alcohol. Everyone's saying she died of cancer. She died of alcoholism. She had cirrhosis of the liver that became cancerous.
Yeah.
And so we're all going to say she died of cancer, poor woman. And so there will be no alcohol. We're not playing that game. I could not
do it.
I could.
And at the funeral, I was in the car smoking joints. So we had asked for it to be a clean funeral, and that's what we were doing. And the thing about the roles is I was the mascot when I was younger, but as soon as I hit puberty, I was doing drugs and alcohol, and I became the rebel. And then I pushed that button. And when my mother died and my father came home, we had this huge fight. Suddenly I was living with my father, who said, okay, you'll be home by 10. And I just started laughing and just said, you know, the hell I will. While you've been gone, here's who I am. Here's what I do. I take acid. I take speed. I do this. I stay out. There was nobody here. You can't come home and tell me this. Needless to say, it blew up. But there was that push after being cute and being the mascot that I moved into the rebel. So it's not, as Karen said, it's not fixed. These roles are very interchangeable. But when you see a family system that's this toxic, and we do in recovery, we absolutely do. You can say, so you were the hero. I'm okay. Yeah, you fit the rebel perfectly. You can really identify it.
Do you think there's one type that is more addiction is more prevalent for? Like hero, lost, rebel, mascot. Do you think addiction is more prevalent for one of them?
I would say in the order you just said them.
I would say the rebels first. It depends on the age, of course, but I would say the rebel is the one that goes out at first because they usually say, fuck it.
I would say the mascot, because the mascot's the one who's like putting on like a face, right? Who's kind of like... Ooh. Putting on a mask.
I feel like the hero because they're like having to button up and be this like straight A, everything's okay. And inside they're like screaming.
And just to make it a full circle, I would say the lost child. Yeah. Because the lost child has the only out they've got is being alone. And their level of depression is usually greater. And there's no outlet. They're just seen as being moody often as kids and weird because they're artistic or and the reality is it's all of us. It's all, no matter which role we have, it's the manifestation The rebel doesn't care if anyone sees it. Yeah, I'm using. You would too if you were smart. Mm-hmm. Whereas the rest of the system is going to hide it in one form or another. Mm-hmm. And also, a lot of things that go by the wayside as not being addiction are the ways that we start as you. Like I said, which food? Nobody pointed at me and said, oh, you're a full-blown addict, even though I was sneaking into the kitchen where my mother was sitting drunk with her back to me. Mm-hmm. And I would make 8 to 10 to 12 pieces of French toast with maple syrup and take them back into my room and eat them at 12 years old. Mm-hmm. That's full-blown addiction.
My first addiction was food too, Karen. So I understand that.
I bet you're the hero.
I am. Yes. Yeah. I'm an only child, but I am a hero. You still have a family role in a family system.
Yes, absolutely.
And I use this role system in my couples work. So I've done a lot of deep diving, and I would go between hero and mascot, but I'm definitely hero.
I wonder if there's more pressure when you're an only child to fulfill all the roles.
Or to fit into one role and stay there when you can't.
For sure. For sure. And some of it's avoidable and some of it's not, right? Like I think you said at the beginning, when there's a dysfunctional family, the roles are more prevalent. But they're always these roles. Like everyone has, there's always a role in a family system. Yes. Yeah. I wanted to ask, what is both of your first experience of using substances? And do you remember if you were trying to escape or soothe? Now, I know, Karen, you talked about food being your first substance. But do you remember if you were trying to escape or soothe?
Maybe soothe, but I didn't have that word. It was more like, it was always sweet. And what I wanted was to feel filled up. What I wanted was some sweetness. But I didn't have that language, mm-hmm. you know, to match the metaphor I was using to show the world what I needed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so metaphorical, but it's so unconscious. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for me, it was absolutely to numb out and not feel the intensity of what I was feeling. And it was almost drugs and alcohol at the same time. I turned 13, and it was between 13 and 14, and everything hit. This was the Bay Area.
I was just going to say, but did you really know that's what it was then?
In retrospect, yes. At the time, no. At the time, I was having fun, but I knew what I was doing was not feeling, but I didn't know. I couldn't have put words to it. No,
right.
Exactly. But what I was doing was having fun, but I had fun much more than anybody else did in terms of when I started drinking. Honestly, I was drinking to blackout almost from day one, from day one. And every single weekend, we were, you know, we had a group of us either drinking. I started drinking, smoking weed, and taking speed all at about the same time in junior high. And it exploded. And it really was like, oh, okay, now I can be okay in my body. Oh, and I wouldn't have known I was numbing out, Karen, that's true. But what I did know is I was okay in my body when I did that. Yes. Whereas before that, I was not okay in my body. I was gawky. I was skinny. I didn't belong. I always felt like I was running to catch up. And that's an interesting metaphor because now I walk faster than anyone I know. And part of that is because I always felt like I had to hurry to catch up. And so now I've embodied that. But it was absolutely about, oh, okay, I get it. I'm okay in myself now. And so there was some consciousness about it. And mm-hmm. that was, alcohol was first, but speed, and I was never all that crazy about weed because it slowed me down. So I like speed because it sped me up.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, It opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
So what were the early signs that drinking wasn't just about partying, that it was something deeper?
Something more serious?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it was an issue rather than a choice.
Correct.
And that it was dangerous or scary rather than this. It's cool. Look how cool we are. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That happened fairly early on for me. I would say I was probably about 25. I was blacking out. I didn't drink in order to black out. I didn't have a choice. I blacked out because I drank too much and my body was getting saturated. And it was the disease acting like the disease of alcoholism in our brain, and the dis-ease at the very least, even if you don't believe in the disease model, which a lot of people don't anymore. But I do see disease with the hyphen whenever I talk about it. And so I was probably about 25, and that didn't stop me. I remember sometimes when I'd have a hangover and be in that process, and the recovery usually took 2 to 3 days, I would get scared about what was happening. But I had convinced myself that my mom was an alcoholic, and she sat at home and drank. So I went to bars. So I was fine. And that worked for a while. What really happened for me, honestly, is I started getting in trouble with the law.
Okay.
I now see my higher power as being the police. you know, if they're going to intervene and knock on your door, it's like, hello, Karen, this is your third DUI. And so that was an impetus and a major, major impetus. And it wasn't because I saw it as proving I had a problem. It was because it caused fear. I started to be scared that I was going to jail. And that's been a theme for me. What really happened that made the big difference is I woke up one morning with a hangover as usual and had been in a blackout, and I couldn't remember much of my night before. And I had this huge feeling and thought of, I am going to die if I don't stop.
Mm-hmm.
So, but up until then, I don't know that I saw it as addiction. I couldn't let myself yet because that was my mom. Even though it was my dad, too. Yeah. And our grandfathers. And, yeah, I mean,
intergenerational. Yeah, intergenerational.
Very intergenerational. For
me, I absolutely had an easier, softer way, which is unfair. Karen was older than me. I saw what was going on with her. And Karen brought me to my first AA meeting. I think I told you guys this when I gave my story, but I was going to support her, right? She brought me when she got sober and brought me to a meeting, and I was going to support her. So I saw her, wait a minute, I saw her getting sober, and that was a wake-up call. The second piece was, or I don't know which is first and second, to be honest, I guess, I was in Japan with my boyfriend that became my husband. And he said, I can't do this anymore. And Jeff and I talked about this the other day, and he doesn't remember this. And I'm like, how the fuck can you not remember this? Anyway, he broke up with me when we were traveling together and I thought he was my forever partner because he said, I can't watch you drink anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I had two people spotlight my addiction and my behavior. And then finally, the last piece is I went to a psychic and she pointed out things and said, oh, this is interesting on your chart. And she said, is there addiction in your family? And I said, yeah, my mother died of alcoholism. Oh. How about this? Well, my dad, yeah, he's still a practicing alcoholic. Makes sense. But how about this right here? So, well, my sister actually is an alcoholic, but she's in recovery. She goes, oh, that's wonderful. Congratulations. But there's this, Patty. And then she just looked me in the eye and said, are you an alcoholic? And so I had Karen take me to my first meeting supporting her. But I saw, when I got off the plane and I saw Karen, I said to her, what is different? You look different. What are you doing? And mm-hmm. I saw that she glowed. And I thought, wow. And she was my drinking partner, my favorite person to do cocaine with and anything else that anybody would put in front of us. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw her look healthy and good, there was that. And then she brought me to a meeting so I could support her. And then Jeff said that. And then I had the astrologer / psychic say, are you an alcoholic? And I freaked out. And 2 days later, I went to my first AA meeting. So mm-hmm. I had a softer way, as Karen said, you know, police being her higher power. I had real gentle higher powers tapping me on the shoulder. And it was gentler and it was easier.
Mine was mm-hmm. too, Patty, because I watched my brother get sober first. And so I think part of it was just accepting it was easier. So looking at him thinking, oh, he had a problem. I probably have a problem. And that's when I started to realize there was some sort of generational tie there. It was the same thing when I first went to the therapist and was diagnosed with depression. They're like, who in your family has depression? And I was like, well, mm-hmm. and then you're like, this person, like,
yeah,
so
yeah.
Did you guys trace addiction back further into your family tree?
Oh, it's everywhere. I think I mentioned both our grandfathers that have been identified. Both of my mom's sisters were alcoholic. Neither of them are alive anymore. One of them just died 2 years ago. But what's interesting is when you get into recovery, you start mm-hmm. to see how addiction can manifest differently in different people. And yet that's the very excuse we use. See, I don't do it like her. So I'm not. Yeah. So, and then our great aunt was alcoholic. She'd be in the bathroom puking at every family holiday. And everybody said, oh, she's just not feeling well. Pour me a drink. So that was present. And the other thing that is really present in our family system that we can trace back is the denial and how it mm-hmm. shows up differently on both sides of the family.
Both sides.
And yeah. And Patty and I were just talking about this as we talked about coming today. And we've certainly talked about it before. And I'll just say a little bit and then you can go into more, Patty. But on my father's side of the family, look good is so important. And being cheerful, good Catholics is really important. So it's like that classic, the three monkeys, speak no evil, see no evil, hear no evil. Oh, everybody's fine. Everybody's fine. One of the stories that really stands out to me is when Patty went to Ireland.
Yeah, I was going to say
and she
say
found
that.
All this history about the alcoholism in our family. The history, the lineage is great.
Yeah. The one, just a couple of stories that stood out when we did talk about it is my father and my aunt both saying the one thing that stood out in their family system was their father from Ireland, who was a raging alcoholic and would embarrass them so much. You know, one story that stood out in folklore was him driving up on the lawn and falling out of the car and passing out on the lawn in the front yard. And people walked by there going to school and how mortified our father and his sister were. But for me, especially when I was younger, my grandmother's house was my safe place. I mean, we just remembered as being this place of love. And she was this big Italian woman, and she was cooking wonderful food. And so I held on to that as this is my safe place. The reality is that when we look back, is our grandmother was incredibly codependent and probably had OCD when we look back on what some of her behavior was. But as a child, she was my safe place. She was my loving, amazing grandmother. So that, we can trace it back on both sides. I mean, Karen and I didn't have a prayer. And now the interesting thing, Karen and I are the only ones in either system, on either side, that got into recovery. And so we were, by many, poor Patty and Karen. Oh, they had the mother that was the alcoholic and died. And so, I'm glad that they found recovery. Whereas Karen and I are looking at the systems and thinking, oh my God, holy shit. Yeah. Thank God we're here and that we can talk about it and do this healing while we watch the other people in the family just spinning and doing more. And we see how it's benefited our own kids. But anyway, that's a whole other
story. How has your relationship as sisters shifted, or did it shift once you both got sober?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, people talk so much about recovery in terms of going to AA or NA or doing the work around the addiction itself. And I feel really fortunate because not long after I got into recovery, I also went back to school because I recognized that I wasn't doing the work I would be better at. And so I started learning a lot more about the truth of what is at the base of addiction. Mm-hmm. And I still use my professor's definition of addiction, which is from transpersonal psychology, which is a repeated behavior with a predictable outcome that is an unconscious and unsuccessful attempt at self-healing, which to me is just so loving. It's really about, we're doing the best we can. We're not worthless people doing stupid things. I'm passionate about it. But within that framework, what also kept coming up, and we were really lucky because of the era we were in, is family systems. So we got as involved in adult children of alcoholism as we were in addiction recovery. And then simultaneously and side by side did codependence work. Mm. And so we were unpacking our family system within, I guess I had about 3 years of sobriety at the time. And Patty, that meant you were pretty new to it, but we did it together. And it just made all the difference in the world because
absolutely,
we started forgiving ourselves for being stuck in these toxic patterns that we were in. And we also started being able to say out loud things that were forbidden to say in a toxic family system because they were secrets.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And John Bradshaw used to say over and over and over, secrets are our secrets. That's where our sickness lies. Mm-hmm. And so speaking that truth out is how we get free.
Yeah,
exactly. And we had, I'll let you share more about your side of it, but we had some times that were very challenging where our old quotes would come out because of how we felt slighted or, you know, seeing each other's chaotic, toxic behavior, and we'd move away from it and then feel guilty about it, but feel like we had to survive and the other person was hurt. And we were able to bring that out and let some healing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's impacted our relationships
completely.
Significantly.
Completely. And the thing that's interesting to look at is, as I said, Karen was my favorite using partner. Absolutely.
Yeah,
and
we'd
buy each other drugs and alcohol for our birthdays, etc. We'd go off together for celebrations. She was my favorite person to get high and drunk with. But in getting clean and sober,
we did our own work. And then, as Karen said, we did ACOA work and we started seeing the patterns. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean we healed them immediately at all.
Mm-hmm. No.
But when we clashed, we could see it and identify it. And as Karen said, there were times in sobriety where we had to pull away because we had to take care of ourselves and then come back.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is we always came back. And each time we came back, we got stronger. And we could use the same language. You know, that's huge, where we could say, I'm cleaning up my side of the street here and I own this, this, and this. And if we pause, the other person can answer, you know. Whereas with my husband, I'll pause and he doesn't fucking get it and it makes me crazy. So I can say those things, or Karen can say them. We can acknowledge it. We can thank them and then step back and own ours, because we learned the language. We mm-hmm. learned how to operate in the system. And like, we've both got a lot of sobriety and clean time under our belts, a lot between both of us. And we both relapsed about the same time and then came back in at about the same time. So we've got a lot of history. But even now, I find that sometimes we go into the swinging silver balls because, you know, I'll do something or Karen will do something and we have the old toxic reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I react to her reaction, she'll react to my reaction. It happens, but it's so much shorter. And
yeah.
we can own it and we can say, oh, wow, I see what just happened.
I see. That's the thing, is we see it. Yeah, absolutely. And when I think back to our old arguments, it's so, our patterns would show up. Patty's already said she was the rebel. She was really good at extricating herself and leaving. And that made me despondent because my biggest issue was abandonment.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
so it felt personal. And it would be terrifying. And it would feel like she was leaving forever. And so as the unhealthy person I was, my reaction was grief, but it was also rage.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was trying to pull her back in.
Mm-hmm.
And now we see it. It doesn't happen that way anymore. And if she needs space, I don't feel like I'm going to die in, which is how mm-hmm. I felt. And she doesn't feel like, if she doesn't run, I'm speaking for you, but in my sense, if she doesn't run, she's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah. she's going to get sucked into this place and never get out. It's just, yeah, the process of recovering yourself. And mm-hmm. that's the truth. That's what we do in recovery. We don't just put down a drug or alcohol or food or whatever it is. We recover ourselves,
yep.
our deepest truth, our hearts. And we start to see our value instead of all of our character defects.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things about recovery is, if you're doing it with 12 steps, especially, which is beautiful and I love it, but, you know, look for your character defects. Well, it's like, if you grow up as an adult child of an alcoholic or addict or other dysfunction, that's all you do is see your defects.
Yeah.
The real healing, you see your beauty.
Yeah.
See your gifts, acknowledge them, own them, be able to start to feel like you can stand up and sit up straight and be part of the world
yeah.
and not be worthless. And when the two of us come together from that place, oh my mm-hmm. God, it's just, yeah,
it's really beautiful. It really is. And adding to that, as, you know, as these products of the system that we were brought up in, we have a shitload of codependence as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, we haven't even touched on the codependence, but seeing it, that's the other thing that we can identify. We're not just two old, you know, old addicts that just aren't using anymore. And we have all of the sticky, slimy, codependent, caretaking stuff, you know, that tarry, sticky stuff that it takes a lot to extricate,
yeah.
dear God, you know? And again, I go back to thank God we did ACOA work. But it's not just, as Karen said, put down your drink. And it's not just, you know, creating these firm boundaries. you know, it's so much more, and learning to love ourselves first, and then, yeah, all of that. So, and most people that I know that are products of these kind of family systems,
mm-hmm.
which is a majority of the people that I know, are carry all of this. I know very few people that are just pure addict and no yeah. codependent.
Yeah.
Plenty, you know? And I know a few codependents that haven't picked up a drink,
mm-hmm.
but their addictions show up in other ways. So I yeah. think it's products of these kind of toxic systems.
Mm-hmm.
We learn to survive. And as Karen said, we survived. So,
yeah,
you know, mm-hmm. that's huge. But the one thing that really hit me just then that feels important, that was part of that era as well, that I don't hear talked about as much anymore, that I think is vital. There was a book around that same time frame by an author named Ann Wilson Schafe called mm-hmm. When Society Becomes an Addict, that really speaks to how addictive the entire culture is. And uh-huh. I can only speak from being in America, because that's where I grew up. That's what I saw. That's what speaks to me. That's what capitalism breeds, because it's always being one up. It's always being better than. It's always having yeah. more, more, more. And
for sure.
that just cultivates addiction in myriad forms, workaholism, greed, et cetera, that we're seeing just a touch of yeah. these days. Maybe just a smidge.
Just a touch. Just a yeah. touch.
Yeah. But honestly, I think that's true in most of the Western cultures to some degree. And it was a book that just, and it was really about white male patriarchy in large part, not just capitalism. But just the title for me works. We didn't mm-hmm. have a choice. You know, you're born and bred in a system, and then your family system is adapting. And when it doesn't have healthy adaptation skills, mm-hmm. it blows up and shows up as toxic right. family system.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, I don't know. That seems powerful to me.
That is really powerful. And I think also what is powerful is that codependency piece, another like maladaptive mechanism. And so the hardest thing I think I've ever been through was when my brother relapsed. And I was so codependent that I thought, well, we just have to fix it. Let's just go to a meeting. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. Like, then you do this, and yeah. then you'll do this. And he was like, fuck you. Just go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
And so what was it like for the other sister when one of you relapsed? And I guess it's happened with both of you. What did that feel like? And what was your instinct the same as mine, which is like, let's go to a meeting. Let's go to rehab.
I'll speak on this first, because Karen relapsed first. And then I followed her because, you know, she's my big sister. And if she did it, then I can do it. It terrified me when Karen mm-hmm. first relapsed. It terrified me. But we weren't living in the same place. So I didn't have that same response. It scared me. I was sad. And boy, maybe I don't remember that well. We didn't talk about it much. We sure didn't mm-hmm. talk about it that I remember. And I think I relapsed within a year after you.
I was going to say within 15 minutes, but maybe maybe my memory isn't all that great. Maybe it was a few months, but it was pretty close.
It was close. But we had both pulled away from going to meetings. We both had shit going on in our lives. And when I can say, as the younger sister in watching, when Karen relapsed, it gave me permission. So mm-hmm. that was part of it. It scared me because I knew I wasn't real solid in my recovery. And watching her, I was sort of watching like, is this okay? Is this okay? What is this? And I remember the knot in my stomach, like it really scared me. Mm-hmm. And then Karen got into recovery before me the second time. And I'll let Karen go into this, but what I do remember vividly, I was in New Zealand and Karen was in California, and we'd get on the phone and I'd talk about the ways that I was drinking safely, you know, I mean, like, well, I'm making sure that I have several AFDs, alcohol-free days. Remember those? And I would talk about being tipsy and not drunk. And I'm not drinking that much, and making all of these stories. And Karen would say things like, so why are you drinking at all then? And I was like, oh, well, you know, I'm whatever fucking excuse I was making. I don't know which one it was, but I do remember, yeah, the initial thing was scared. And then I thought, okay, I guess I can too. So that was me. Karen?
Well, during that period of time, I do remember talking to you. I really remember sitting on a couch talking about it. And one of the things that just really stood out to me, and of course, Patty is going to need to speak to her. I know part of it was doing it together. It became permissible, acceptable, fun. Like, we can do this. We're so strong. We have so much recovery. It won't be a problem.
Yeah, and, exactly.
And all of those different feelings. Yeah. But what stands out to me the most about relapsing is I used all those excuses. I know so much. It won't be a problem this time. I used all those excuses. But the real truth was I relapsed because my marriage was so awful. And I had a little girl. And I couldn't hold the truth of those feelings and keep the marriage going. But I didn't feel like I had a choice. So I became a part of a group of women that drank wine. Because, of course, that's the whole thing, right? Yeah. Women who drink wine together glow in the dark. And then when Patty and I could drink together and we could, I still remember this feeling of, as long as I keep one pinky extended and drink out of a cut crystal glass, I'm fine. Except that after the third one, I'll drink out of your shoe. So maybe not so classy. And I do remember when Patty didn't get sober and I was concerned and knowing that I couldn't say much because I had just gotten sober again. Who am I to say anything? And yet I was really concerned. And besides, I wanted a playmate in sobriety again. Yeah. And wanted us to be doing it together because our work had been so rich together.
Do you feel like you've broken, both of you, the cycle of addiction, or are there things that still show up in your life?
That's a great question. Such a great question. Yes, things still do show up in my life. And let me just answer the question on a different note. The difference is our kids. You know, the difference is that what I see with my sons, is miraculous. And I can absolutely say that we broke a multi-generational pattern. Absolutely broke a multi-generation pattern. There is no question. Does it still show up in my life? Oh, fuck yeah. But I see it with my kids. And I got this most beautiful email from my daughter-in-law. And she and I have had some difficult times. But she is the mother of my grandson. And she said, I just want to tell you how grateful I am that you broke that multi-generational pattern. Because I can see what Lucas, my son, does as a father to our son. And she said, you did this. You broke a pattern that was huge. And I'm so grateful. So that's how I can see it.
And a slightly lighter, lighter tone, because that is beautiful and powerful. I think a really important piece is our kids don't do excess. And you could say maybe that's just in front of you, but we're so close to them that we would see it. Yeah. We would absolutely see it. And the lighter piece that I was going to use is when my daughter and I will be talking, and my daughter will frequently say things like, gosh, Mom, is drinking an issue in our family somewhere? you know, it's our addiction. Is it? I haven't heard you say that since yesterday. You know, it's just, it's such, it's been a part of her life to such a degree. Not heavy handed. I don't think Patty did ever either. Be careful or watch out or none of that, because it's like, you've got to make your choice and walk through it in your life, however that shows up, and I'll be here 100%. But nonetheless, it's, you know, I'm so, and my daughter's been to meetings with me when I've spoken, for example, and sat in the back and cried, because, you know, it's things, when we relapse, she did see. Nothing like what it used to be like in my 20s, but nonetheless, it's been present, and that's not easy for me to own. And the family patterns that I hadn't yet healed, that were so unconscious, that she's had to experience, and that we've been able to talk to or talk about. I think it's absolutely amazing what we can do when we break those family patterns. And the other thing that stands out to me that feels true, and I may be in total denial, it would not be a surprise, but I don't think so. I fully believe that with all of our kids, if they had a problem and they were worried about it, they would come to us. And they wouldn't be ashamed, and they wouldn't try to hide it from us. So that feels like a miracle, considering what we can trace back.
For sure. I think those are such huge wins, both of you, what you've added. I know, thinking that I have a child and there's a history of addiction with me and with her father, I honestly think that's such a huge win. If I could say that one day, if I could in 20 years say that my daughter, I'm going to get emotional.
Yeah.
It's huge.
It's huge. Because you worry about it when you're raising
them. Of course.
Once you're conscious of it. It's like, this isn't, just because I'm sober doesn't mean that my child is going to escape this. Not have to do this in order to get through this.
That's right.
And it still could happen. Our kids are like, you know.
Absolutely.
30, either side of 30.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why Kathleen is emotional is, so I have three nieces. One of them is Kathleen's daughter, and the jury is out, right? They have experienced this, unfortunately, because of my brother, very similar trauma to us. And so I try to think about what would help them and if forgiveness is the answer. Do you think forgiveness is necessary to heal from family trauma? I'm really easy to forgive. But I don't know how much that helps.
Oh, I'm going to let Karen go into detail about it, but I'll just jump in real quick first to say, absolutely, it's vital. And just one piece before Karen can go more, elaborate more, but it has to be done in time, because what I've always said is, if you just jump directly into forgiveness without going through the grief and the pain, it's like having a dirty wound and putting a Band-Aid on it. It just festers. It's got to be cleaned out and then move to forgiveness. And I've known many people that just say, well, I've got to forgive. And it's like, well, first you have to process it. First you've got to let that anger out, or that pain, or that grief, and then move to it. But I'll let Karen go into it.
Well, I think that was a big piece of it. And it is, the phrase I used to hear is, it's like having an amputation and putting a Band-Aid on it, you know? Like, let's just pretend everything's fine. The phrase that we grew up with was forgive and forget. Mm. So when someone told me I had to forgive, that I bristled because, no, I'm not going to forgive. Let's look at what really happened. I'm not pretending anymore. So forgiveness is really about processing my grief. It's about walking through the pain that I experienced as a result of the things that happened, and then really learning that my reaction was my reaction.
somebody else would have a very different reaction. And in fact, as Patty and I have described, because of our roles, because of our process, because of our own experience within the context of our family system, we did react differently. We still had to forgive, but from very different places. Because I had been carrying around, for example, rage and deep resentment because I felt worthless. I just felt absolutely worthless. And so I had to clean that up. You know, feeling worthless is how it manifests usually is a lot of self-pity. A lot of self-pity. And that's about me being special. And I can't look at what you are bringing to me that I need to forgive, whether you know you're bringing it to me or not, and not have cleaned up my side to say, I'm a fully responsible human being in this exchange, in this interaction, and in this present moment. Yeah. And so I need to forgive you because you're human and you're acting out your reality. And I'm so lucky that I've gotten the opportunity to recover and heal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what a gift that is. And it's available to all of us, but some of us are too scared to take it.
Yeah.
It's not because we want to be mean. It's not because we like being said. It's none of those things. It's scary to confront this stuff. So cultivating compassion really helps bring about true forgiveness. And the compassion only comes when I've given it to myself too. And you know, that sounds good. Trust me, in 20 minutes, I'll be beating myself up. But it's just such a huge journey. It's such a big process. It's so forever.
Yeah, it's so forever. Exactly right. And my favorite quote is the quote from Annie Lamott that says, you know, not forgiving is like drinking rat poison and expecting the rat to die. Yep. So ultimately, the important thing to remember for me is I need to get the anger and the pain out, and then I'm going to forgive for me, not for you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to forgive so that I can move on, because otherwise I'm carrying it around and it's not healthy for me. So, you know,
yeah. And as so many people say now, because the era of the way work is done now is really different from the models that we've been talking about. You know, it's about boundaries and it's about facing your own trauma, and which is all really important. But it is what has come out of that. There are people that we must forgive for our own well-being that we may choose not to interact.
Exactly.
Yes. Because we'll keep getting triggered in a way that's unhealthy for both of us.
Exactly.
It's more like, I'm really sad for you that you haven't been able to face these demons, because they are demons. But I also know that for my well-being and for me to remain compassionate toward you as opposed to brutal toward you, I need to take a step back and keep that space between us.
Yeah.
At least for now.
I love that. I needed to hear that today. So I think that's a great place for us to end with forgiveness. And thank you guys so much for being here.
Absolutely. And I, you know, it's such a gift to us and sisters who have done this work to sort of reflect it back to people who don't know us well. It's really profound, because it's not about us. It's about all the tools we've been privileged to be exposed to as a result of all the work that came before us. And what a gift that is to share it back with you and hopefully some people that may find benefit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. We need those tools.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all do.
Thank you for the invitation. And this is fun. This is the first time that Karen and I got to do this. And what a perfect venue, Sisters in Sobriety.
I know.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. I love it too. Thank you for listening to Sisters in Sobriety, and we will see you next week. This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.